Hey, you.
To be this good, take sacrifice.
Hello, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Whenever you're listening to us in whatever part of the world you are, you're listening to the Sega Guys. I'm Dan, the Mega Driver, aka Swooper D. And here with me, as always, my good friend, he's the Olaf Olafsson to my King Kutaragi. It's James. How are you doing, James?
I'm very well, mate. Thank you very much. Yourself?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. I thought I'd give you I thought I'd give you Olaf as opposed to Ken. Thought you might appreciate Olaf a little bit more than the father of the PlayStation brand.
Aye, I'm getting a wee bit itchy there at the Kutaragi, so you know, just it's a strange one, mate. We've actually got a show with no guests. It's just us.
It is. So yeah. So the last two episodes, we have of course had a couple of humdingers of guests. Really, we had Andrew Dickinson on from Dreamcast Years and Dreamcast Year One, which good friend of the show, absolutely brilliant to have him on. And of course, we had Al Nielsen on. And of course, if anyone's been following us on Twitter, we also have a very special guest with Tom Galinske coming. So that's in the pipeline. So it's been wonderful. It's been a wonderful few weeks to have some brilliant guests on, mate. But it's grown back to our usual business as usual for us. And hopefully we've got a really good topic for our listeners.
Yes. Pub Patter is back. get the pints and the scampy fries, and here we go.
Yeah, and be prepared for tangents and all sorts of all the usual.
You can't have tangents with Mr. Kalinske. He's just one of the best public speakers I've ever had the pleasure of talking to, man. It's like, that's what I says to you on WhatsApp, like, after we finished. Like, we had them for an hour, and I looked at the audio, and it was an hour and 5 minutes that we had. Mm-hmm. And in that hour and 5 minutes, I think we got more than probably, I don't know, the amount of just content, insight, knowledge, experience that we got in that hour and 5 minutes is absolutely insane. So yeah. If you're listening to this when it's new, then that's to come. If you're listening to this as part of the archive, then we hope you enjoyed Mr. Kalinske's interview.
Absolutely. So today then, we've got a very special, a very interesting topic for our listeners. And I think they all know that me and you love our sliding doors Sega moments.
Yes.
And it's quite telling that we've had this. I think we prepared this one before we spoke to Tom. But having spoken to Tom now, I think there's a little bit more to this one. So, yeah, it's what would happen if Sega and Sony did agree to create a console together back in 1993, and what would it become? So a bit of background, first of all. I think if anyone who doesn't know this bit of console history, originally there was, you may know, the Sega Mega CD or Sega CD, and as it was in the US, there was also the PC Engine CD or TurboGrafx CD in the US. Nintendo actually had their own CD hardware coming, and that was planned to be a CD add-on for the Super Nintendo, and that was being developed by none other than Sony. But come CES 1991, you've got, I can't remember who it is that stands on the podium, but they, I think it's Howard Lincoln, or it might be, it's someone in Nintendo, and they say, oh, we can't wait to show our brand new CD hardware with this leader in the industry, Philips.
That's what you call a slap in the face.
Wow. I mean, absolutely crazy. That I think it came from Yamauchi, the head of Nintendo at the time. He wanted to humiliate Sony for some reason. I think they leaked that the deal was made, and Nintendo didn't want it to be made public. Whatever the reason, they ditched Sony and went with Philips. Of course, that CD hardware didn't manifest either. So what happened was there were a few conversations at Sony, a few meetings between Olaf Olafsson, who was representing Sony, and our good friend Tom Kalinske. And they were discussing hardware and software. Software first. Sony became a staunch supporter of the Mega CD, created a lot of games for it. Even games like Night Trap, which were published by Sega, were actually originally Sony products. So they were part of, I think it was a VHS line of VHS interactive sort of video experiences or something. So they moved that over to CD. And then they decided to discuss hardware. But unfortunately, as we all know, James, that deal was nixed at the last minute.
Yeah, and again, from speaking to Tom, he does still, you know, take that quite personally. He wasn't able to get that deal, you know, over the line. You know, Nakayama basically vetoed it out the gate because Sony apparently weren't experienced enough in the video game industry for them to take them seriously as a partner at that time.
Yeah.
And it just makes it even more baffling. Because that was 1993, and when you think that in 1995, obviously the Sega Saturn came out and was rushed out on the orders of Nakayama and Sega of Japan, and the fact that within 2 years, and if you include R&D time in that as well, it's probably a lot less. So for me, that's the baffling thing, is that how could you go from writing them off as not being a worthy partner because they don't know what they're doing, and then 2 years later, fear them that much that not only do you put an extra CPU in the Sega Saturn, but you also then order Sega of America, who have been wildly successful, have proven their worth, and you tell them to release the Saturn with hardly any software, no retail backup, And obviously the infamous E3 where Tom obviously, you know, announces that, oh, it's out there right now.
Yeah.
So it's a bit bizarre that there was that change in mindset within Nakayama within such a short period of time, you know. So was there more to it? Was it just a genuine dislike of Sony, or was there someone at Sony that he didn't particularly get on with or didn't want to work with? Because obviously they can't have been not experienced enough in terms of the kind of technology, because they were obviously R&Ding the PlayStation at that time. You don't go from Sega said naughty, here's a PlayStation within 18 months. Yeah. You know, it's like, so there was things going on, but yeah, it's definitely a sliding doors moment. What could have been, what wouldn't have happened, you know, had that deal gone ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting because there are different accounts of why that deal didn't go through. There was some discussions around hardware. Apparently Sony wanted the hardware to be 3D focused, which we know is what they've went with the PlayStation, whereas if I think it's in Console Wars that they say that Sega want to do a 2D 3D hybrid with the Saturn, which obviously the Saturn was, and a reason why we love it dearly is because of that. It's so good with 2D as well as and it's capable with 3D. So, I mean, that was always the plan with the Saturn, for it to be capable with both, whereas the PlayStation was solely 3D focused. Apparently there may have been a disagreement with hardware. So it is interesting, especially when, as you say, for Nakayama and the rest of the Sega board to say, no, thank you. And then Sony to go it alone. And interestingly, I mean, I don't know enough about the PlayStation story, but I know Ken Kutaragi in Console Wars is, you know, he's sidelined. He's the board really go after him because they don't want to go into the console space. So he obviously fought tooth and nail to get the PlayStation out. And then obviously they went the whole hog behind it. And again, it's like you say, yeah, that Sega of America and Sega Japan were fearful of what the PlayStation was becoming, which turned out to be rightly so, unfortunately, given how that console battle went.
Yeah. And that whole aspect as well, that, you know, Ken Kutaragi had to, you know, fight tooth and nail. And even to this day, Sony or the PlayStation almost comes across as almost the kind of, I don't know, the runt of the litter when it comes to Sony. You know, it's, I think Sony Corp acknowledged that it does make a great amount of profit, but I don't know, it never seems to be fully respected by Sony. I always get that impression that it's kind of sneered upon almost even now, you know, because Sony's obviously, it's got a Sony badge on it, but it's a Sony product. But, you know, you've your Sony Corp, your Sony Electronics, your Sony Music, your Sony Movies. And I know video games is, you know, twice movies and music combined now, but it's just weird that there never ever seems to be this kind of appreciation for their own product. I mean, you look at what happened, you know, recently with, you know, Andrew House left, and then Sean Layden, the way he departed. I mean, Sean was doing a great job. I mean, I like Sean Layden. I thought he was great to watch. He spoke well. He was good at the keynotes. So was Andrew House. He spoke very well. He was passionate. You could tell Sean Layden was a gamer. you know, much like Phil Spencer, you can see these guys play games. And I don't know, it's strange the way that, Sean Layden kind of left. There was nothing else said about it. There was no real thank you from, the, Sony or PlayStation accounts. It was just very much, he's away, cheerio. And then obviously, well, we've got the new head honcho who's come in, Jim the Mouthpiece Ryan. But it's strange that they always have seemed to be the kind of bastard child of the company. Yeah, you know, it's a strange one.
It's interesting because, I mean, as of the last few years, it's their largest earner. It makes the most sales for them. Even more than, you know, their home entertainment side. So there is something, PlayStation almost feels separate from Sony sometimes. It really is that there is a different image to it all. But it is strange the way that it's looked upon, which may tie into what we're talking about today, because of how would Sony look at a potential merger with Sega. So obviously we know what the PlayStation became and how successful it was, and we know what happened to the Sega Saturn. But what if in this sliding doors moment, Sega and Sony said, right, okay, shake hands, let's work together, let's create a piece of hardware. Where would we be today? So I think there's still hurdles that would have to be overcome. We know that was the case with Nintendo. I believe that Sony wanted, they wanted the license fee for all CD hardware, or CD software, which Nintendo weren't happy with. But I think Tom seemed to suggest that they were, the financials were quite favourable to Sega. He thought it was a slam dunk.
Yeah, that's right. That was the words that he used. He thought it was a slam dunk. It was an absolute no-brainer. You know, that both companies, you know, got involved. It would have been beneficial, obviously, to Sega, because if you think about the fact that, you know, Sony do have a background in consumer electronics, so they would, you would assume, be covering a lot of the kind of R&D costs on their end of it as well. But yeah, I mean, that was the kind of the stumbling block with Nintendo, was obviously that licensing fee. Were Nintendo ever serious about going into business with Sony? I think if you read the book and you look into it, I think, as you say, it was that kind of public humiliation exercise for whatever reason. But yeah, I mean, if you try and look at what happened after that, you're talking about 93. So, like, the 32X is 1994. So that straight away probably never happens.
Yeah.
You know, and then you've got to look at it that both Sega and Sony at that point in time would have been looking at Saturn and PlayStation as their own standalone units, taken into, you know, time R&D. You don't create a console in 18 months and launch it. So you've got to think what parts of what machine would have been, you know, brought across, what brand would have been on it, you know, what would, I mean, I know the Nintendo console was the PlayStation. Yep. It wasn't until the PSX is the moniker it got that it became the PlayStation. It was everything, you know, put together, capital PS. So, you know, would it have been, you know, the Sega PlayStation? Would it have been the Sony Saturn? You know, you've got to think what would the launch titles have looked like? You know, what would the internal hardware have been? You would probably think, with the focus being on 3D, and I think the fact that maybe Sega of America wanted to move away from the kind of 2D aspect if they were forced to. I think, you know, Tom and Al have obviously said to us that their preference would have been to stick with, you know, Genesis, Mega Drive for another year and ride that out, which I think, given the success that they had earned, and the hard work that their team had put in, they earned the right to do that. I think that was probably the right call if you look at history as it went. But yeah, I mean, you would probably find that the more simplified 3D orientated, 3D focused hardware of the PlayStation would have more than likely formed the basis of any kind of new Sega PlayStation at that time. But I think obviously the 32X would have been bye-bye, gone. So I mean, you just look at it, that's your kind of main point, is what parts of what hardware would have been amalgamated. I think the PlayStation as it was, or as it became, would have been the kind of focus and the kind of the blueprint, the building blocks of any new system. But maybe there might have been a wee push to shove some more 2D elements in there.
I think so. Especially given Sega's history. Now, at the time, I believe they wanted to push a lot of their System 32 stuff, because a lot of the capabilities within the Sega Saturn are System 32 special features, and Sega were very keen to push those. And you know as well as I do, when you see some of the, I mean, the Infinite Planes from Panzer Dragoon's Vi, for example, absolutely magnificent. So some of the trickery, some of the special features that the Saturn has, owing to that 2D architecture, you know, you mainly see it in stuff like Guardian Heroes and stuff, and you see it used as 2D backgrounds in Virtua Fighter. But yeah, I think there should have been some give and take, maybe. But we are the Sega guys, and we appreciate the Saturn for what it is, because part of the 2D and the way that the games look is part of the appeal and part of what we love about it. So I feel that maybe the 2D side would have remained if it was looking back at that System 32 hardware. Would they have used quads instead of triangles? Like the Saturn uses quads, the PlayStation uses triangles. But one thing I was thinking about is, you're 1994, the Mega Drive is doing well, but everyone's worried about the 3DO and the Atari Jaguar. Sega and Sony are producing a single platform together, so that's their rival is 3DO and Atari. Now, knowing the arms race leading up to the Sega Saturn and PlayStation's launch, you had the various like consumer shows. You'd have someone from the Sony says, "Oh, the PlayStation could do 300,000 polygons," and someone from Sega would say, "Oh, the Saturn can do 400,000 polygons," and then someone from PlayStation would go, "Oh, but the PlayStation can do 500,000 polygons." Without them two trying to one up each other, is the 3D side of that Sega PlayStation as powerful as either system became?
They kind of drove each other on, didn't they?
Yeah, they really did.
Say that kind of egging each other on. I mean, just to kind of, you know, touch what you said there about the kind of differences in the way that they approach 3D, I think that's quite important, because it's strange. They're both the very first basic 3D, you know, powered consoles.
Yep.
But for both being 3D, they both have a very distinctive look. And okay, yep, Sega guy's biased, but I think that Saturn's 3D has aged a lot better than PlayStation's 3D. There are some examples on PlayStation, don't get me wrong, that look great. I mean, some people Final Fantasy VII. Well, Final Fantasy VII's 3D characters with 2D backgrounds, you know, so just, you know, calm down there. But yep, you know, I think the first Gran Turismo has not aged well at all. GT2, I think, is okay. Metal Gear Solid holds up very well. Tekken 3 speaks for itself. But I think if you start Ridge Racer Type 4, Rage Racer, I think they're great games. I love Rage Racer. Funny story, sorry, there's tangent number one back. Rage Racer, right? I played that in Blockbuster Video in a competition, and you get three shots. And in my third shot, some wee Ned came in in Blockbuster Video in Partick, sat down beside me and said, "Here, mate, you're shite at this," and I crashed into a corner and lost. There you go. True story. My mate Sam will back me up on that. He listens to this. Guy had a yellow puffy jacket on. Mate, you're shite at this. Oh, thanks very much. Crash. That's it. Can I get another shot, mister? No, that's it. Fine. Manager chucked me out. Another shot. But I think Saturn 3D has aged a lot better. You know, Panzer II, Sega Rally, Virtua Fighter 2, Last Bronx, you know, even Fighting Vipers, it's lower resolution, but I still think the arena elements of that, the destructible rings, there's just certain things that Saturn does in the 3D space that I don't think PlayStation does quite as well. Obviously, PlayStation does transparencies, and there's a whole debate and argument over that. So with that in mind, what does Virtua Fighter 2 look like on PlayStation, you know, tailored 3D hardware? What does Sega Rally look like? What does Virtua Cop look like? All these kind of things. Is Panzer Dragoon, you know, especially as Vi, is that as impressive a 3D feat you talk? I mean, I sometimes just put Panzer's Vio on just to watch the demo loop.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Because the ice level, where you're above the clouds and you swoop down all the kind of, you know, different kind of leveled you know, planes, and it just goes for miles into the distance.
I love that. That's another example of just the 2D side of things, just and VDP2 doing all this stuff. Obviously, you've got the polygon pushing and everything, but VDP2's doing a load of stuff. But it's quite amusing because if you're playing that level, obviously, for some reason, everything's locked to VDP1, I believe, and they obviously the CPUs. So when you pause it, everything stops except for the VDP2 effects. So the snows continue to fall while it's paused, and I think the water still moves as well.
You just get the impression that VDP2 sits in there and goes, right, boys, come on. I'm still going here.
Come on, will you hurry up?
I'm talking like the big man for chewing the fat. Young man, the big man, so you're taking in the background doing all this business. The guy's paused the game away for a push and you're still sitting there. Look, I'm doing the snow. It's like, I'm still firing out effects here and you're taking a break. Come on. But it is the unsung hero of the system. It really is. So, I mean, again, would the games that utilise that, you know, would they have been quite as impressive had they been on, you know, PlayStation tailored hardware? I don't believe they would have.
No, I think there are things that haven't aged well at all and were a little ugly, let's be honest, back in the day. Both systems obviously haven't aged perfectly. I mean, they are made in 3D systems. You know, the only things before them were, you know, Super FX chips, the aforementioned 3DO and Jaguar, which were primitive compared to what came after. But it's interesting because I don't know how. The big inspiration for the PlayStation's 3D, it's no secret, was Virtua Fighter. The Virtua Fighter was the game. Yeah. They saw that running. And it's like, our console needs to be 3D. It needs to be 3D. And I think everyone, when they saw Virtua Fighter, thought the same thing, that 3D was the future. But Virtua Fighter, the Model 1 board and the Model 2 board draw polygons as quads. They don't draw them as triangles. They don't have issues like affine texture warping. So, Virtua Fighter 2 on PlayStation hardware, doesn't look the same. No. I don't think.
And what you said there as well about, you know, them being made in 3D systems and they do have imperfections. You know the kind of the key one I think is the flickering, which from memory I think Tekken 2 had flickering polygon issues. I remember parts of Yoshimitsu's green trousers going missing at points in my PS1 whenever I got it. So, yeah, I mean, there was kind of, you know, the kind of basic errors you would expect as developers find their feet and try and, you know, build for a new way of playing and looking at and controlling games. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, and I think the fact that Model 1 and Model 2 did draw in quads as opposed to triangles is one of the reasons why, again, Sega got the most out of the Saturn in terms of arcade ports, because again, it was what they were used to working with. So, I mean, Virtua Fighter 2, phenomenal port. I'd still rather play VF2 on the Saturn than play the arcade perfect version on the Xbox, which might seem utterly bizarre to some people. You've got an arcade perfect version there, James, just play that. No, there's something special about the Saturn version. I think just looking at it just looks, and we've waxed lyrical about that port many, many times on here, but yeah, I think that kind of aspect of it, that the arcade hardware was mirrored to the home system, albeit toned right down. So would Sony have then possibly, given that Virtua Fighter was the catalyst for why they went that route, why they wanted Tekken, they got Namco on board, would they have perhaps then looked at it and went, well, hold on a minute, we've got a partnership with these guys, let's try and strip down your arcade units and marry it with what we're doing. You know, so again, sliding those moments.
Yeah, because it's interesting that you mentioned the Tekken side, because obviously Sony came in, you know, with some hardware, but they signed Psygnosis for quite a lot of money to be their first party company, and then obviously, they greased the palms of several other developers and publishers to try and get their games exclusive to PlayStation. So, of course, there were things that Sony did to counter Sega before, not to counter, but in to prepare them for the fight for Sega. So obviously the biggest game in there in 1994 when the console was released was Virtua Fighter. Obviously, as we know, Virtua Fighter 1 sold one-to-one with the Sega Saturn. It's a tremendous success in Japan. Astronomical sales figures that Sega had not could only dream of before. So Sony wanted to counter that. So obviously they had Kata Shinden, they had Tekken. Do those games exist? Does the Shinden get the push? It, you know, remember that we've said this a few times that it was the Virtua Fighter killer back in the day. I know, we look at it now and we laugh.
How often did you hear that line in school?
Oh yeah.
Well, what did you play in Virtua Fighter for? Have you not played Ta Shinden? Yes. And it's mint.
Yeah, I have fun with it, but obviously it's nowhere near as good as Virtua Fighter, let's be honest.
I think if you'd played that, maybe in a way, they're not comparable as games in terms of quality, but it's a kind of similar circumstance to how Western gamers see Virtua Fighter 3 and Soul Calibur on Dreamcast. It's like, if you played VF3 when you got a Dreamcast on import and it was the only fighting game and you seen it really early and like all you'd had to compare it to was like Virtua Fighter 2 and Last Bronx and Fighting Vipers, then oh my god, man, there's no pixels, it's yeah. So smooth and all. And then you come over here and you've got them side by side in the UK, US, it was a couple of weeks apart, and all of a sudden the shine gets taken off it. I think it's a kind of similar idea with Ta Shinden. I think had it come out a couple of weeks or months before Virtua Fighter, it might have looked okay and played relatively well. But I think the fact that it was alongside or just after Virtua Fighter, I don't think it just looked like a cheap imitation. You know, I rented it from Blockbuster. It was to quote Classic Gaming Quarterly, a weekend rental. You know, so. So that's what it was for me, was just a weekend rental. But I think it would have had to have come first to have kind of stood out.
I think so. But does it get the push? If Sega and Sony are working on the same hardware, does it get the push?
Because, probably not.
And even more interested in that, I think, is when you consider Namco's partnership with Sony. Namco obviously had a very strong partnership with Sony, and a lot of my favorite games, and by the sounds of things, yours, mate, your Tekkens, your Ridge Racers, they're some of my favorite games on the system. Now, obviously, that partnership with Namco, massive rivals with Sega in the arcades at that point.
Yep.
They were in an arms race themselves. You know, Daytona was a response to Ridge Racer, which in turn was a response to Virtual Racing, which was in turn a response to Starblade.
So the Chuckle Brothers,
yeah,
to me.
Oh, I know, mate. So while Sega are actually fighting on two fronts in terms of this arms race, but you got to believe that Sony turned around to Namco back in 93, 94 and said, "Look, we're creating a console. We want you to bring your arcade games to it." And part of that resulted in the creation of the System 11 board.
Yeah.
So the first question is: do we get Ridge Racer as good as it looked on PlayStation? Do we get it on the Sega Sony system? Do we get the System 11 board, knowing that Sega are, you know, Sega are working with Sony on this one? They're not going to give the board to Namco. Do we get Tekken? Do we get ports of Time Crisis? No, it's very interesting when you consider that.
And do you get Soul Blade? And then does the Dreamcast get Soul Calibur?
Yeah, it's a sliding doors, mate.
That's the thing, right? We said we're going to do this podcast, and I stupidly said to you, "Aye, we can just cover everything in one." It's like, look at all the permutations, and I love stuff like this, and I know it's all pretty much what if and what if, but it's amazing to see how one decision would spread through like tree roots through the ground. You know, it touches so many companies and so many different, you know, areas, home areas, arcade areas. Yeah, I mean, as you say, System 11 board came about because of obviously that partnership with Sega Sony and Namco. So does Tekken even exist? Or, you know, I was going to say maybe Namco end up using Sega technology to make those games because they talked to Sony, but without Sony needing an arcade partner, they don't, Sony don't go to Namco if they don't need an arcade partner. So no,
that's the thing.
So, you know, it's basically your whole slew of, you know, Namco games, your Tekken, Ridge Racers, Time Crisis, all pretty much ceased to exist because they were more or less created to counter the Virtua Fighter, you know, Daytona, Sega Rally, and Virtua Cop series. So, yeah. You know, they effectively would, along with the 32X, just fade away like Thanos.
Like Marty McFly's Fighter Family before he starts, before his mum and dad kiss again.
Aye, well, Ken Kutaragi's hand starting to fade away as he tries to play the guitar.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Earth Angel, Earth Angel. I'll get the singing back. Will you be mine?
My darling dear, love you for all time.
That's the thing. If you're still with us, thank you very much.
I think Ridge Racer obviously existed before the deal, and obviously the port for that was, you know, massive for Sony at the time, massive for the PlayStation.
Yes,
so Ridge Racer would have existed. That was on System 22 hardware, which was more powerful than PlayStation. Well, you know, dream mode, having Daytona USA and Ridge Racer on the same system in the launch window. You know, Namco made games for the system. You know, that would have been amazing. I doubt they would have used Sega's arcade hardware. Probably would have stayed on System 22.
Yeah, they, I mean, they had an arcade rivalry before there was, you know, PlayStation and Saturn anyway.
Yeah.
You know, those guys. So that was already, I suppose, that was in existence. I remember Ridge Racer. That announcer used to annoy me. Wow, what a start! This is just what I wanted to see. I want to mute you. That's what I want.
Yeah, Daytona won the announcer battle. Trying to go easy on the car.
You're burning up a tire. Five laps to go. Hang in there.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just see Robert Duvall when I hear that guy's voice. I'm not going to lie. It's just Days of Thunder, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think I actually watched Days of Thunder when they were developing that.
Wouldn't you be surprised? I mean, you know, Yu Suzuki was watching all these, you know, kung fu movies to get ideas and movement for Virtua Fighter. So just imagine a team of Sega AM guys sitting watching Days of Thunder.
I'll have to dig the article out, mate, but I'm pretty sure. I was reading something the other day, and it said that they all watched Days of Thunder because virtual racing was obviously formula racing, and that was popular in Japan, and that was popular in Europe. But they said, oh, we need something. If you're going to make this new arcade board, it needs to sell big. We need something that appeals to America. And I was like, if you want to go to America, if you want a game that's going to target America, make stock car races. And I think all of the AM2 guys are like, stock car races, perfect. What the hell is that?
See, I still think, see that moment, you know, that first hairpin on the kind of the 3.7 Speedway, right? You basically, if you take the power slide wrong, your ass hits the outside and you go flying up. Yep. I just think you should have had, no, he didn't slam you. He didn't bump you, he didn't nudge you. He rubbed you, and Robinson is racing.
Oh, mate, I think they missed the trick. They should have just called it Days of Thunder and it would have been perfect. So you can get Yu Suzuki back and make a Days of Thunder Daytona game. Come on.
Just make it a patch for the Xbox 360 version. Just add it on there.
Yeah. Oh dear, but I mean, talking of driving games, obviously Polyphony Digital was another, I think that it's probably their best their first party developer for PlayStation. You consider, you know, they had some first party games and they had these second party and third party exclusives, but do Polyphony Digital exist? I mean, obviously they changed races entirely. Do we get Gran Turismo?
Again, I think with them being a first-party studio, I think they would probably have been formed still. I think that would still have come to fruition, but obviously, what does the game look like? Mm-hmm. Again, you look at, you know, Gran Turismo 2 running on Dreamcast, on Dreamcast, all smoothed out. So is that maybe a wee hint of what could have been there? I mean, Gran Turismo, I mean, it's the first game, as I said earlier, hasn't aged well at all, but back then I think I was 17. In fact, I remember I got Gran Turismo in a pack from GameZone, and it was a PS1 themed disc holder. It was like kind of really hard, well, kind of semi-hard.
Exactly. Calling us at
22:05 PM. We're past the watershed. Hopefully you are where you're listening. But I opened it up and it had these wee kind of disc holders, and I stupidly put loads of discs in it and held it and then put them in my cases, and it actually scratched a lot of my discs.
All right.
And the outside of the case was like a PS1. That's what it looked like. It was like the kind of the circular disc drive and all that kind of thing on the front of it. But I remember getting like Gran Turismo when it came out, and that intro was mind blowing. I remember watching the intro. It starts with a do 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 do, and it builds the kind of the manufacturers, and the logo goes together, and boom, car engine, and then you're away. And I remember watching that thinking, wow, imagine if the game looked like that. Now we have Forza Horizon 4, which looks better. So I think that would probably have existed. That would have been a first party studio that would probably have more than likely come over, because Sony did have that draw. I think that lifestyle aspect would still have been front and centre. I think they would still have chased down, you know, like a Psygnosis, and you know, you look at Wipeout and Wipeout 2097, you know, Polyphony, as we said, with Gran Turismo. Those kind of things, I think, were pretty much still ideas that they would have had and would have carried out. I think the main kind of sliding doors moments more in terms of the hardware itself and the kind of the arcade relationship, as we touched on.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we spoke to Tom, one of the things he said is, well, that the plan was for Sega to get their license fees from the games that they published, and Sony to get the license fees from the games they published.
Yeah.
So it probably would have made sense for Sony still to have Polyphony Digital and Psygnosis and pump out their games in order to get that precious license money, which, when you think about it, that would, I mean, again, we're in dreamland now. We're getting, you know, Wipeout, the best version of Wipeout. We're getting Gran Turismo on the same system that we've got Sega Rally, Daytona USA, you know. Mate, what could
have been? Great Scott!
I mean, what Sega did to counter Sony, there wasn't an awful lot, was there? I mean, they drove them to improve their Model 2 ports after Daytona. So do we see those improve? I think they need to anyway, in order to sell systems and sell software. Panzer Dragoon Saga, though, does that exist? Because obviously that was created. No.
Nope. Not a chance. I think because obviously the way Final Fantasy VII went, you know, that was the catalyst for Sony finally overtaking, you know, Sega in Japan. You know, the sales were quite close up until that point, and FF7 is renowned as being the game that kind of pushed things over the edge and made the PlayStation just go in the stratosphere. And it also transcended, because I don't think... Okay, you look at the SNES with Chrono Trigger, and it's a renowned kind of title, and there was Final Fantasy games that were on the NES and the SNES, but also use your Fantasy Star games on the Mega Drive as well and the Master System, but they were very niche. But Final Fantasy VII is definitely, from memory anyway, and remembering the buzz around it. I mean, my best mate Sam's wee brother David, man, he was in his room playing Final Fantasy VII for God knows how long. I mean, that boy loved that game. Just used to hear the battle theme coming out of his bedroom whenever he went down to visit. he loved that game so much. So I don't think there'd been a JRPG that had kind of grasped a Western audience quite as much as FF7. So yeah, Panzer Dragoon Saga was, you know, Sega's response to that, a kind of cinematic themed JRPG. But even at that, we were lucky we've seen it over here.
Yeah.
You know, we spoke about Bernie's words about Saturn's not our future a couple of, you know, episodes ago, leaving us with, 18 months or so between any form of Sega hardware presence and just letting these games drip out. So Saga was amongst those, and it just didn't get pushed. So I probably Panzer Dragoon Saga is just left by the wayside. Just, is it even thought about?
Mm.
Does it just become part 3 and do they make it a shooter?
Yeah.
Does it just become like an on-rails third game along the lines of maybe like Panzer Dragoon Orta.
Yeah, I think you're right, mate, because as much as we're sitting here, you know, in dream world, if this had happened, we'd have Wipeout, Daytona, Sega Rally, Tekken, Virtua Fighter, all this wonderful stuff on one system. But I think Panzer Dragoon Saga would have been a very real casualty to that, because without that rivalry between Sega and Sony, without the success of Final Fantasy VII, Panzer Dragoon Saga doesn't exist. It was created solely to compete with it. It was so ambitious and so wide in scope because of it needed to one-up Final Fantasy VII. It cost an awful lot of money and nearly killed the development team. I don't see it happening, unfortunately, which is very sad, because you'd think if we've got this new Sega PlayStation and it's as successful, which we'll probably get onto in a bit, if it's successful, then titles like Panzer Dragoon Saga, in theory, are more plentiful in supply. But I think that's unfortunate casualty. But coming back to Final Fantasy VII, do we believe that comes to the Sega PlayStation, as it were?
Probably does. I would imagine, again, these were deals that maybe Sony were looking at in advance. But I mean, the thing as well you've got to look at is that both consoles have got very unique identities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they've got their own kind of DNA, and, you know, it was more than likely going to be Tom Kalinske who got that deal over the line. You know, he had to sell it to Sega of Japan. And knowing what we know from, you know, speaking to Tom and Al and doing the Console Wars, you know, documentary and the book, is that they made a lot of very good decisions that helped make Sega very prosperous in the US at the end, you know, pretty much in spite of, you know, Sega of Japan. So had Tom got the deal over the line, you know, just how much of Sega's identity would have been, I mean, would Sega of America, assuming at that point Tom stays in charge because he's obviously managed to get that deal over the line, how much of Sega of America's DNA transfers over to the Sega PlayStation, you know, and how much of Sony's comes over? So if you imagine you've got like a red side and a blue side and that line down the middle, and red's Sega of America and blue's, you know, Sony, what percentage on either side of the line does the identity of that system fall on? Is there more pushback from Sony? Is there more pushback from Sega of America? Does Sega of America have to talk to Sega of Japan to get the go-ahead to go with ideas that Sony are wanting to implement? So, you know, how much of each system's identity do you lose in that case? Because we're talking about, you get VF2, you get Sega Rally, you get Virtua Cop, you get Time Crisis, you get Final Fantasy VII, but you don't get Panzer Dragoon Saga. You know, and again, it's all hypothetical, but it's great fun trying to theorize what would have happened. But you talk about that blue sky feeling that the Saturn has.
Mm.
How much of a blue sky feeling does a Sega PlayStation have?
That's a very good question, mate. I mean, it's excuse me. It's interesting when you think of Sega and Sony teaming up, and when we were speaking to Al, he was very keen to. You know, very proud of the fact that Sega really drove that lifestyle, feeling that the PlayStation now embodies. The PlayStation really does feel like a lifestyle product, and that's, you know, stuck with the brand all the way through to modern day. Sega started that. Sega started saying, well, we're not going to target kids in toy stores. We're going to target the older brothers. We're going to target everyone else. You know, so Nintendo can have the kids in the toy stores will have everyone else. And then obviously that, you know, as you know, as we know, big brother tells little brother, yeah, you know, little brother wants the device after that. So I feel like there's some continuity between the Sega image and the PlayStation image, at least in those early days. And I think that's part of the reason why PlayStation was so successful initially, because what Sega did well in capturing that audience with, you know, the edgy advertising, Sony one-upped it. And of course, a lot of the marketing guys, particularly in America, went over to the PlayStation side. Obviously, we know Steve Race, who's he did a lot of the Reebok ads that poked fun at Nike back in the day. He did some of the early stuff for Sega and then moved on and did to Sega. what Sega did to PlayStation, did to Nintendo. And I feel like that Sega and PlayStation is a better fit than Nintendo and PlayStation. Because if you think of the SNES CD, the Nintendo PlayStation, as it were, the image doesn't quite gel there. You know,
you can't imagine Gran Turismo with Mario.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Exactly, mate. So I think they could have found, in terms of image and feel, I think that there is something in common there. But again, you look at the stuff that Sony drove. If you look at Daytona USA, excuse me, you look at Daytona USA.
It's my load.
I'm parched here, mate. if you look at Daytona USA and compare that to Wipeout, two completely different games that embody their systems. One's Blue Skies, Rolling Star. And then you've got the other one, which is Firestarter, Prodigy, Dark Skies.
You try to imagine each person in their bedroom playing it. So yeah. You've got the people playing Daytona nodding away, and, you know, with the sitting there playing quite happy, and you've got the other side, PlayStation, banging their heads, you know. a mini mosh in their bedroom playing this. Yeah. Prodigy, and it's like Firestarter and whatnot. So it's two very contrasting styles at that point.
Yeah, I think there's some commonality there, but then, yeah, it does diverge. The Blue Skies and Sega does differ to what PlayStation offered. And again, PlayStation was cool at the time. So I don't know, maybe Sega were just gone with what was profitable and what was popular. It's hard to say. So yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, one thing that we haven't discussed yet is rivalry. Obviously, we touched on the fact that without the Jaguar, without each other to compete with, there'd be the Sega PlayStation would be competing with the 3DO and the Atari Jaguar. Which, let's be honest, I think respect to those systems, but I don't think they're even in the race at the races. So the Sega PlayStation, as it were, has only got one main rival coming down, and that's the N64. The thing is, I don't think the N64 is affected by this whatsoever. Yamauchi was so stubborn, especially when it came to CDs, that I think it doesn't change at all. The N64 lands exactly as it is.
That's the thing. You look at them, they've just, apart from the Wii, they've never embraced full-size discs, have they? I had a Wii for 3 months and I sold it. I thought it was absolute garbage. Sorry, Nintendo fans. But I had a GameCube. I liked the GameCube. Try to save myself here. But I mean, the GameCube had tiny Wii discs. You know, the N64 was cartridge. SNES and NES were cartridge. You look forward again, you look at the Switch. They're basically SD cards, you know. So, I mean, they never ever... It's almost as if they've always rebelled against CD, even till today.
It's all proprietary storage. Obviously, cartridges, and then you had the GameCube, which was mini discs. I can't remember what they were called. Even the Wii and Wii U, I don't think they are true DVDs. They're similar formats, but again, I think it is to DVD what it is to the, but it's the Wii discs to a DVD are, in my head, I think they are what the GD-ROM was.
Right. Yeah. A proprietary, you know, they look the same to the naked eye in terms of, you know, dimensions, but in terms of the drive that reads them and the stories that they have on them, they're more proprietary.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't think that they ditched the cartridge format. I think they stay the course on there. Which is, we know we've spoken about Final Fantasy VII, and historically Final Fantasy was a Nintendo product. They had Final Fantasy VI, Final Fantasy III in the US. Had that brilliant relationship with Square. You know, you look at Chrono Trigger, you look at Super Mario RPG, which really cements how well those two companies work together. do they jump into bed with Sega and Sony? I think for the same reasons that Final Fantasy VII made its way over to the PlayStation, it's the same reasons it comes to the Sega PlayStation, because Square didn't want to be tied to cartridge limitations, size limitations, and they didn't want Nintendo censoring the product.
Basically, I think Square were ready to take Final Fantasy onto that kind of cinematic level, which required optical media. So, yeah, I think that deal still happens.
Yeah.
But then you look at it, and while the 2D backgrounds of Final Fantasy VII aren't anywhere near taxing on the PlayStation, if there had been an element of the Saturn's 2D brought across, Would Final Fantasy VII have looked a wee bit better?
I think it's quite possible. I mean, the thing about Final Fantasy VII is, I think the battle sequences are obviously the most impressive, but I think they run at something like 15 frames per second, and I think part of the issue is that although the backdrops are in there, they're like in boxes, aren't they? But they're all polygons.
Yeah, you know,
because they're not the floor and the scenery. It's not pure 2D. They've had to map that. It's similar situation to Tekken. That's why in Tekken you can see the floor appearing and disappearing, because that has to be a polygon rather than what the Sega Saturn does is it draws the limit on VDP2 draws the unlimited planes. So again, me and you are just singing VDP2's praises here, mate. But if it's got VDP2, Final Fantasy VII, I think it could have been a bit of a looker.
Would it still have had the trumpet music when you win, though?
Oh, it's got to. I mean, I'm a big Final Fantasy fan. I love Final Fantasy VII. Do you know what? I'm not too dissimilar to you, mate, because, it's a thing about this console war stuff today. Everyone's slagging each other's consoles off and everything. There was a bit of banter between me and my mates on the PlayStation Saturn. I was one of the only people with a Sega Saturn, but I used to swap with my mate. We used to say, "Oh, can I borrow your Saturn?" Like, yeah, can I borrow your PS1? And he had Final Fantasy VII with his, and I was similar. I locked myself in the bedroom for about a week, especially since I thought, I've got to give this back to him on Saturday. I better get through.
No, I mean, like console wars back then were far more jovial and friendly and more interchangeable than. You got the odd ribbon and that game's rubbish, and oh, you should have this, and I've got that. That was more based in kind of childish. You were bought something by your parents, and you wanted to say that it was better than what your pals had, kind of thing. Whereas today, it's just toxicity, and I mean, even today on Twitter, as we discussed earlier, you put out a very valid, politely worded, non-confrontational point about current now, or it was next gen now. We're now at the point where we call it current gen. It's not next gen anymore. It's here. It's been here for about 6 months. So, and people, I think, just, there was no hashtags or anything like that. I think people just search for the word Xbox or PlayStation or Switch, and then just, they wake up in the morning and go, I'm just going to go and fuck somebody's day up. Yeah. You know, and it's tiring. I remember being on the CVG forums in the kind of mid-90s, and again, there was kind of banter between PlayStation and Saturn and N64 later on, and as the kind of 90s progressed, and it was nothing to this level.
Yeah.
I mean, it was childish and it was fun and jovial, whereas now it's very, very serious and quite poisonous at times.
It is. It's just a shame, because, I mean, I think part of the fun in us talking about this topic is how different the actual hardware is between the PlayStation and the Saturn. We've talked about triangles versus quads. We talked about VDP2 or lack thereof. Talked about how there was a 2D focus or a lack of 2D focus. I mean, at the end of the day, the two systems couldn't have been more different, which is why it's interesting to talk about it. And it was why it was interesting to have a little bit of banter back then, but also why everyone was so keen to, do you mind if I borrow your PlayStation? Yeah, borrow your Saturn. Yeah, I'll borrow a Saturn. If you give me your PlayStation, swatch that round, you're like, yeah, do you know what? This is decent, actually. And I was like, oh, what was your favorite games? Oh, I loved Virtua Cop and I love Virtua Fire. What did you like? I like Final Fantasy VII. You know, they were so different and they offered such different experiences that you could really appreciate them, the different things of them. But now you've got people arguing over frame rates, and the games are nearly identical, and you've got I still like playing modern games. Hopefully getting my Series X delivered soon, because I think that looks awesome. My son's got one. It is awesome. So I want one myself. But there is something, the magic has gone a little bit.
I think a lot of the soul's been ripped out of, not so much gaming, but I think and maybe it's us getting older. Maybe it's the kind of midlife crisis kicking in, and we're looking back to our youth and picking out the things that we loved. But as the games back then, we can appreciate, like, we are the Sega guys, but we did both own PS1s. Obviously, got my PS1 97, so a year after I got my Saturn, my own Saturn. But I mean, I can still look back at PS1 and pick out. I mentioned the intro to Gran Turismo blew me away. I mean, the intro to Final Fantasy VIII is absolutely astounding. The score that goes with that is amazing. Ridge Racer Type 4 is one of the best arcade racing games that I had played. We all remember where we were whenever, Psycho Mantis told us that he was reading our minds and we had to change the controller port. And if you were stupid enough like me to have a Sony television, then the goddamn font mirrored what the AV said. So I turned the freaking thing off, didn't I? We all remember trying to rescue Meryl from Sniper Wolf, and, you know, just, again, taking three, seeing that for the first time, seeing Final Fantasy VII, you know, Tomb Raider 2. I remember I pre-ordered Tomb Raider 2 from CA Games that I used to get my imports from. And it was before Charlie expanded his shop. And he just used to have, literally, you walked in, it was like an upside down L shape, and the cash desk was up in the top right hand corner. And I remember going along on my lunch break at college, I'd pre-ordered it for a fiver, and I had to go and pay my balance. I had to hand my cash over a crowd. It was literally like crowd surfing. Like, the crowd of people in that wee shop that were all buying Tomb Raider 2 was insane. So I mean, I've got great gaming memories in general of PS1 as well. It's not as if I'm going to sit here and go PS1 was shit. You know, it wasn't my preferred system, but I did have some good memories on it. Again, my pal Sam will be listening to this going, I have never owned a PlayStation, never wanted a PlayStation. He's held out, man. Fair play to that boy. And he's even to this day, he has absolutely no interest in playing any PlayStation games. Doesn't appeal to him at all.
It took me till 2001 I broke. Obviously, after Sega had it in the towel, but it was just Sega consoles for me. Had the Saturn, and then got the Dreamcast on import, and then it was all Dreamcast until they turned to hand in the towel out. And I got a PlayStation 2 in 2002. I think 2001 I got someone have sold their PlayStation 1 for a PS2, and I think they got that a bunch of games. I think it was a chipped PS1 as well, so it had a bunch of CDRs with it, which was nice. But I played plenty of it before, because my mate, you know, everyone seemed to have one, and I've got some great memories playing some games like Street Fighter Alpha 2. I first played on the PlayStation. I think that's an astounding port on the PlayStation, despite what limitations it might have compared to Saturn in terms of what it does in 2D. I think Alpha 2 probably is the best 2D game on the system. It's an amazing port. Obviously, I got the Saturn port after and never looked back, but yeah, fantastic memories with it, mate. But I mean...
See, just the thing, I'm just going to be kind of tangent, but this is the thing, you want to talk about PlayStation 2 there, right? See this whole situation with PS5 and Series X and S, where you can't get them for love nor money, and like Currys or Argos or whatever, I'll put out a stock alert, and then I'm trying to get one for my nephew, right? Because my sister-in-law and her man, they kind of get one. They're not working from home, so if I see a stock alert, I jumped on it, and Currys put one out today, and I joined the queue, and it was 55,500 people before you get in. You have no chance. And I'm like, I remember the PlayStation 2 whenever... You walked in, you picked your retailer, so you picked Gameplay whenever they had high street stores, a few of them in the UK. I think Leeds had one, Glasgow had one, Manchester. They weren't as widespread as like Electronics Boutique at that time. But you walked in, you chose a store, you walked in, you paid your £20 and filled in a form. That form then went to Sony, and then you got a proper headed paper, Sony PS2 letter through from Sony, and it said, Dear Mr. McGee, we are pleased to inform you that a PlayStation 2 system has been reserved for you. The next time you hear from us will be the collection date to go and pick up your console from your retailer of choice. And then you literally waited and you got another letter through maybe a week before your system was due to be delivered to the store, and it told you what shop you put your book your deposit in, what date it was given out to the store, and what time after you were to arrive. And it was all very structured, and that way you knew you'd paid your deposit, you were put in a queue, there was a system allocated to you, and it was going to the shop that you chose, and you just basically walked in, handed a letter over and went, I'm here to pay my balance, there's my letter, give me my big blue box, I'm going up the road. You know, and you look at this absolute carnage that goes on just now. Like, why can't, like, there's more. That was back in, what, 2000 and... 2000, November 2000, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Just before Christmas. My student loan paid for it. it was books, honest. It seems really bizarre that, you know, 20 years on, 21 years on, you can't replicate that and improve on it.
Yeah.
So I just, another wee tangent there, but I just, it baffles me that, and I would think probably PlayStation 2's hype was far greater than PS5's.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, PS5, you have people kind of looking at the Series X and Series S. With the PlayStation 2, you had a fantastic system in the Dreamcast.
Nobody wanted.
Everyone was over keen to overlook that for a PlayStation whose launch lineup was nowhere near as good as what was on the set on the Dreamcast at the time. Such was the furore around it.
Name me one system that's launched without a first party exclusive. PS2. Richard Ledbetter laying the slap down now.
Yeah, I know. But all these great memories we have of Saturn and PlayStation, it's pretty incredible to think that a lot of those could be merged if the sliding doors moment happened. But is it a shoo-in for success? Does it sell 100 million units like the PlayStation did? Obviously, it sells more than the Saturn. I think that's a no-brainer, especially with both of them behind it and no rival to speak of. But is it as successful, do you think?
I think in Japan it flies.
Hmm.
I think the fact that it's an amalgamation of, at that point in time, and even today, to an extent, you know, Sega are still well thought of in their home country, with their arcade and theme parks and all that kind of thing that they've still got going. I know they've closed their main kind of big arcades down now, which is a shame. Yeah. But I think at that point in time, you're talking mid-90s, Sega and Sony, you know, two of Japan's largest corporations merging, I think that thing flies off the shelf. The only thing that I think impacts the Western, you know, outlook of the system is, can Sega of America and Sega Europe cohabitat with Sega of Japan? Would Sega of Japan's, you know, pride have perhaps got in the way of decisions that were required to meet Western tastes? You know, they allowed Tom Kalinske to go away with his team and drop the price of the Genesis and pack in Sonic and, you know, Nakayama. You're wanting to give away our secret weapon. You want to give it away for free. And he was allowed to do that. But if decisions had to be made to make what would be a very Japanese console, you know, as we said, merging two of Japan's, you know, biggest tech giants together, would decisions that, you know, obviously Sony weren't afraid to make decisions that tailored the console to each audience. So I think they're the only kind of kicker in terms of Western successes. Would Sega of Japan's pride have allowed them to let Sega of America continue to make, and Sega Europe make those changes to tailor that experience to a Western audience?
It's an interesting point. I mean, if we're sticking with Sony, have bought Psygnosis, then straight away they have a foot in the sort of the games that appeal to the West. One thing that's always jarred with me is that the SNES launched with F-Zero, which is a stunning launch title, but that doesn't seem to get that much respect. But Wipeout launched with the PlayStation, which did get the respect, which I don't think was, considering the hardware, as impressive. But they captured the zeitgeist. They captured the attention of the audience. And I think they had those games to be a success in the West. I also think if you're coming at it from the Sega perspective, does Nakayama go to Tom Kalinske and say, we've got to launch this thing now? I think, first of all, they don't have a rival, so maybe he doesn't. But then even if they do, is it going to hurt the sales of the console? Possibly.
I think the surprise launch thing, just that just disappears Thanos style. Mm-hmm. I think that's just another moment that just never happens, because you say there's no rival there. There's no one. They're not panicking. I think both companies would have looked at Nintendo and kind of rather mockingly, even though N64 would have been up and coming. I think they'd have looked at it that they've got, you know, the best of both worlds there.
Yeah.
You've got that kind of Sony experience, the deals that they've been probably in, having a pipeline with, you know, as you say, Western, you know, third parties acquiring first parties. I mean, if you think back to it, I mean, we look at Tekken, we look at Final Fantasy, we look at Resident Evil, we look at Wipeout. You know, you look at all these kind of franchises that are now multi-platform.
Mm-hmm.
But at one point, you could not get those games anywhere but PlayStation.
Yeah.
You know, they were mainstays, they were exclusives, and people going about exclusive today. But I mean, Sony pretty much wrapped up the major third-party exclusives on PS1.
Yeah, they really did. So, I mean, Sega had their share of exclusives as well. I think there was that question on Twitter the other day, was what third-party Saturn games can you get for this price? And I'm racking from my head, I'm going, well, this is first-party. So Sega's output on the Saturn, first-party output on the Saturn, and I know we've said this before, is absolutely spectacular.
Yeah.
And that's the way that Sony, you know, courted third-party developers and publishers was incredible in its own right as well. To have those mix of both builds an absolutely stellar library.
That was some question, though. I mean, I went over, because what's it, the boy asked me, he says, name three third-party Sega Saturn titles for £20/$20. And I went on CEX and I managed to get ones just a couple over.
Yeah.
Someone replied to say you won't get Street Fighter Alpha 2 for that price. Well, it's £25 on CEX. So, granted, I think that's like the lowest rung in terms of condition. But £25 still good. I think Exhumed was £28, which was a bit bizarre. But again, Exhumed is... Why did the Saturn port of Doom not use that engine? Yeah. Oh, my God.
I mean, Doom's another one which, you know, could have been, it's extremely successful on this hardware. So I think we're in Dream Street. I mean, there will be, you know, sacrifices. Panzer Dragoon Saga breaks my heart to imagine a world where that doesn't exist. But I think the library is stellar. And I don't think the N64 changes what it is. I think it stays exactly as it is. It's a cartridge console with the silicon graphics. It's the most powerful system in respect to the type of 3D that it does for its time, and it has that niche. Unfortunately, I think, you know, I do like the N64, but I think it still has the same problems that prevented it from being as successful in this alternate reality that where Sega and Sony have combined. So I think the Sega PlayStation is successful. How long does that success last? I think that's a difficult question. Are they there for the Sega PlayStation 2, or do they go their separate ways? Part of me even thinks Nakayama, the more I read about him, the more of a stubborn bastard he was. I can't help but think, in the back of his mind, he sits there and he goes, yep, okay, well, we'll do the PlayStation deal, okay? We'll make this Sega console with you, Sony. We'll make these games. And then this is the minute Ken and Olaf and everyone's all gone out the door, he turns around and says, right, we need to start working on a new piece of hardware on our own.
See, I just imagine that the Sega HQ in this alternate universe is like the video game version of Biff Tanner's Pleasure Paradise. You know, Nakayama's up at the top like Biff. Kutaragi's Marty coming in. I was warned one day, a kid and an old man would come back asking questions. Just never figured it'd be you. You would think that what company would have the stronger personality? I mean, if Sony are part of like a Sega system, I don't think they lose the chip on their shoulder for a start. I think Sony are very much the way they are because of the way they were shunned, not once but twice.
Humiliating fashion as well.
Yeah, humiliated by Nintendo and then told they didn't know what they were doing by Sega. I think that would give most people a complex. And I think they've still got, I don't know whether they do or not, but part of me thinks there must be people within Sony at that point who maybe enjoyed seeing, you know, Sega disappear from hardware, almost like a kind of get it up you. So I don't think if they're part of a Sega system, a merged Sega system, they don't have that chip, they don't have that drive or that arrogance that forms. Because let's be honest, they are a very arrogant company when it comes to that kind of, they kind of tend to do this, they have a generation where they're successful. I don't think they've ever managed to carry over. It's like they've only retained the title once, is the way to look at it. You know, it's like the PS1 was a success and PS2 was a success. PS3 was a clusterfuck, then PS4 was a success and 5 remains to be seen. But I don't think they have that kind of chip on their shoulder had they been part of Sega. So, or merged with Sega or worked with Sega. So you look at it and you think what company has the stronger DNA to come forth and kind of take the leadership role.
Yeah.
So do they split after one system and go their separate ways and maybe normality resumes and we go off on a kind of alternate version of what became the norm of individual systems, or do Sony try and acquire Sega? Do Sega become assimilated into Sony, you know, and maybe Sony go their own way and we have the PlayStation 2 and it becomes the Sony PlayStation and Sega just become a Psygnosis or a Polyphony. So again,
absolutely. I mean, Sony was certainly big enough to absorb Sega.
Yep.
And they could have done, you know, if quite easily, depending on the success of this. And obviously, as we go into the PS2 era, a lot of what we know, obviously the Saturn and the Dreamcast were huge drains on Sega's bottom line. But at the same time, their arcade business was on the wane as well, because arcades in general were suffering. So if Sega are just home hardware, home consoles, and they're equal partners with Sony, it's probably logical for Sony to absorb them. They become part of, Sega becomes a subdivision in Sony, however that works. There's several Sega PlayStation, Sony Sega PlayStations. So Sega continue to develop software, maybe some arcade games at the same time, who knows? Or the alternative is they make this one successful console together and then go their separate ways afterwards. And I think, you know, Bernie Stolar's line on Microsoft kind of comes back to me in, you know, when he says Microsoft learned the industry from Sega. You've got Sega and Sony that have been strong bedfellows, rather than them coming in cold like they did with PlayStation. Obviously saw great success. If they had success together and then Sony coming with the sequel and Sega have got to compete with that, they've got all that success and experience under their belt again. And it's something that Sega, I think, would again struggle to compete with. But then Sega would have had all the riches from the joint console. So it's a very interesting scenario.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't, in the end of the day, it wasn't games or quality of hardware that let Sega down. It was just decisions that were made in that kind of 93 to 95 kind of spell that just eroded consumer confidence.
Yeah.
And obviously had this merger happened, those decisions wouldn't have been taken. So I think, you talk about the kind of lifestyle aspect again that Al said, you know, that Sega were obviously the pioneers of with the Mega Drive. They targeted an older demographic. Sony were looking to do that, and they certainly did that with Psygnosis and Wipeout. And I think the merging of two companies who had a focus on lifestyle gaming, then obviously Sega would have reaped the benefits financially from that. So yeah, they wouldn't have had those kind of financial troubles. But I think obviously that the kind of thing to take away is that has that deal, if that deal happens in 93, things that you 100% lose, you know, 32x is no great loss, but the kind of the two that you would automatically lose as well is the Saturn and Dreamcast.
Yeah,
they go. Panzer Dragoon Saga goes, VDP 2 goes. There goes your certain aspects of your 3D performance, 2D gaming, being you know an excellent you know side part of the Saturn. Let's watch a side part. One of the main parts, 4 megabyte RAM card probably doesn't happen. So you don't get those amazing X-Men versus Street Fighter, Marvel Superheroes, all those kind of things. Those ports don't happen. So as a proper sliding doors moment, and as I said at the kind of top of the show, it's amazing how one decision, I don't think I can think of a decision in gaming that has had such far-reaching, I mean, this is what, decades? You know what I mean? You're talking about almost 3 decades you're coming up for.
Yeah.
This has had a ripple effect.
Absolutely. It is absolutely the biggest sliding doors moment, I think, in gaming. And I think we do love to explore these things. I think there's other ones that we'd like to explore, but I think this is the big one because it formed Sony as they are now and created that success that they had in the 90s and then birthed 4 more consoles after that. They're the most successful consoles around at the moment. I don't think that can be... I think that's a fact that PlayStation, in terms of hardware sales, is absolutely top dog. That all came from, you know, Sega saying no. Sega obviously are where they are now. You know, they're solely a software company. Unfortunately, very tragically, have lost a lot of their arcade business now because of COVID. So yeah, it's a very sliding doors moment. It's almost like you've got the guy in the business suit with a briefcase full of money walking around and going to all these glitzy hotels, and Sega's on the other side of the tracks. with a couple of dollars hanging out of its pocket, trying to warm itself up by a bonfire in an oil drum, and you think it could have been so much different. But it's
like Yakuza, is it? No, the guys are wanting you to go and buy a drink for them.
Yeah,
standing with a tin can.
That's right. It's not that bad for Sega, but I mean, they've had a very
bring me some sake.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's funny you talk as well about how obviously Bernie Stoller's line regarding Microsoft, you know, that they got to learn the business from us and then walk away.
Mm-hmm.
But is it not kind of, there's Microsoft, I think, to me, just now with Xbox, are very much a richer version of Sega in terms of facing up to Sony. If you look at, like, Sega were having to try and give the Dreamcast away.
Yeah,
you know, you bundled an online subscription with it to try and push units, and then you look at what Microsoft are doing with Game Pass and All Access. They're bundling the console at a low price, interest free, over 2 years, and throwing in Game Pass. You know, £28 a month for a Series X, and £12 of that or £10 of that is Game Pass.
Yeah,
you know, so it's almost like would perhaps Sega have become. They're not as rich as Microsoft, but they would have had the income and the years of experience from being part of a Sega PlayStation and reaping those no rewards. So would they possibly have gone down that route where they would have been happy to kind of just coexist the way Xbox do?
Yeah.
Because I don't think Xbox have got any notion to be number one. I don't think Phil Spencer has any not I would say no ambition, but I don't think he's got any burning need to see Xbox as being the number one console. I think the end game for them is subscriptions.
Yeah.
So perhaps had Sega continued down their route of going into an online-based console, you know, akin to the Dreamcast, you know, SegaNet would mature, become the equivalent of an Xbox Live. You know, would you have seen like a kind of Game Pass model, an Xbox Live-style model where the money that is made isn't from just the hardware? You sell the hardware at a loss and you realise, hold on, it's a different era. We're not going to sell, you know, 2-3 million 60 quid games, but we are going to sell 15 million £10 a month memberships.
Yeah.
You know, so I think the kind of the Sony, I think, are very driven and very proud of that. We are the number one selling console. I think that that's part of their ethos. I think that's their identity. They want to be that, that monolith in gaming. But whereas Xbox, I think, are quite happy to be customer-centric, you know, low price point with Series X or with Series S, sorry, or you can get X on All Access and you've got your Game Pass bundled under S as well, if you want to go down that route, even cheaper. So I think there's kind of slight parallels, I think, but again, between the Microsoft and Sega situation, how it could have unfolded.
Mm. Yeah, I agree, mate. But one thing that you've said is really interesting is the whole, you know, SegaNet maturing. Because Sega were at the forefront of online console gaming. I mean, before the Dreamcast, obviously the Dreamcast was bundled with the modem. The Saturn had a modem. And as we learned, the Mega Drive, the Saturn was planned to be bundled with a modem, at least from the Sega of America side. That's
that was, again, this all came out before Tom's interview, so I'm not going to say too much. But yeah, that revelation about Saturn, my God, man.
So Sega are looking at online way before anyone else is. So you imagine that, you know, if a Sony Sega PlayStation is very successful, maybe online takes off, maybe in the early days, maybe later on as it gets to like the millennium, that we start seeing online take off. And then when it gets to the sequel, the follow-up system, whether they part ways or they join together, Microsoft only got into the console side because they saw the success of the PlayStation as a threat to the home computer side. I mean, I think that's the story behind it. I think that's been on in the View and Arcade Attack. Someone confirmed, it was only because the PS2 had Linux and because consoles were going online at Microsoft. Right, we need to do something about this. Do Sega and Sony go head to head with Microsoft?
Where do Microsoft learn the ropes from? If there's no Dreamcast for them to piggyback off of,
yeah,
it will go again as another one.
Yeah, I think the whole Sega and Microsoft relationship is another sliding doors moment, which we could probably go on for hours about.
Mental, again, just every way you turn, there's just a decision or a system or a game or I don't know, there's some kind of initiative that we take for granted that happened, that just would not have done so had that deal all the way back in 1993 actually been allowed to happen.
28 years ago, mate. What
I said that on Twitter, man. Can people stop putting tweets up? 25 years old today. 30 years old today. I'm literally walking back for the shops in tears, dragging my feet. I'm like, can't. 25 years, I think it was 26 years in Street Fighter Alpha 2.
Yeah.
And the iconic cover of WWF Magazine with Bret Hart staring down Diesel was the the influence for the cover. You know, just somebody hit the pause button, please.
It's 30 years of Lemmings, mate. 30 years of Sonic the Hedgehog. 30 years of Street Fighter 2 in the arcades.
Lemmings. Let's go. That game.
Amazing. I don't know if you played the Mega Drive version of it. You probably got the Amiga version ingrained in you, but
yes, I do.
There's something about the Mega Drive version, because that's the version I had, and the Yamaha chip and the Mega Drive just make that game sing to me.
I've got it in the Everdrive. I'll need to try it and see. Because that's one game actually I didn't try. I know I'd said that kind of a while back that I'd went through a lot of Amiga games like Cannon Fodder and Turrican and Lotus Turbo Challenge and Legend of Galahad, Shadow of the Beast, Sensei Soccer, things like that. But that's one I didn't touch. So I'll need to go back and have a look at that, because that was an Amiga stalwart.
Yeah, it's a classic game. I love it on the Mega Drive. But interestingly, it's actually now Lemmings is a Sony property that's a Sega hardware. So that's probably as close as we're going to get to a Sega-Sony relationship at the moment. But I mean, just to bring it back round, mate, I mean, so many questions around what the hardware would have looked like, but I don't think that it can be of any doubt that the games library would have been absolutely stellar and the machine would have been extremely successful. But I think the question is, do we, if we could go back in time, we get in that DeLorean with our video games almanac and go...
Video games almanac.
Or we can give that, to Nakayama, and he can make the Sega Sony PlayStation.
walk into Sega HQ with the almanac and call Nakayama a slacker.
How'd you get in my car?
Hello, McFly. Think, McFly. Think.
Yeah, Nakayama finds you in his car. He's turned it over, and he's only I know how to turn that car over.
Oh man!
You give him the video game almanac. You say, look, you do the deal with Sony, you'll see all this success. And going off of what we've discussed tonight, yes, we're over in a stellar library, but we will lose the 32X. We will lose essentially what the Sega Saturn was. Model 2 ports that we know and love would not look the same. And Panzer Dragoon Saga is gone forever. Doesn't even exist. Do we trade that for this deal going through and Sega still being around today?
I have a funny feeling he would probably say no. I genuinely do. I think I don't think he agrees to that. I think that's given up too much.
Yeah.
but you'd still be relevant.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be doing crappy mobile games. You'd still be doing actual games.
Yeah, well, Yakuza is amazing, but
Yakuza, I think, still is a kind of one remaining semblance of, for me, Yakuza is to Sega what Murphy's little bit of humanity is in RoboCop. It's the last bit of their true self that remains.
I think we'll have to see what the Sonic 30th anniversary celebration looks like. If the game's brilliant, then there's still hope. If not, we'll go into the corner and have a cry mate with our retro consoles.
Well, that's the thing. We've still got them, as we touched on earlier. I think whether it's midlife crisis or just missing a certain spark that comes with those games, it's a joy to have them. It's a joy to mod them and you know, be able to discover games that you didn't get a chance to play when you were younger because you couldn't afford them, or your parents couldn't afford them, and obviously getting to play games that you once had and to actually see that they've retained that magic. I mean, Darren, who's on Twitter is Boz, BAWZ. He was talking to me today, and that's what he was saying. It's like if ever there was a game that epitomised gameplay over graphics that stood the test of time, it's Sega Rally.
Mm.
He can't get his boy off it. And he only got his Saturn, 2 weeks ago, if that? And he says his boy's using manual gears already and he's faster than him.
Oh, wow.
He says he cannot get him off it. And I think that's someone who has no affinity for Sega, has no history with Sega, and that's just his dad handing him a controller, and he's loving it. He can't get him off it.
Wow.
You know, so that's a kind of a shining endorsement of just how magical and gripping and just gameplay focused that these retro games are. And it's not to sound like a romanticized, rose-tinted glasses fuddy-duddy, but honestly, I've got my Series S here, and what I've played on it, I do enjoy, but I find that I turn it on and I spend more time flicking through the My Games and apps. And I've got as many games as some people. I've got 165 plus what's on my Games with Gold. I don't like that I've separated those, by the way. I don't know why they have to be separate. Put them all in the one tab they used to be. And I just flick through. And it's like, how can you have so many games and have nothing to play? And that's not me going, the Xbox has no games. I'm not saying that. It's just, there's some cracking games in there, but there's just nothing that's grabbing me that makes me want to jump back in. But Sega Rally, VF2, Crazy Taxi, Daytona, Panzer Dragoon, Anzvi, Anzsaga, Last Bronx, Fighting Vipers, you know, 18 Wheeler, Confidential Mission, Virtua Cop, House of the Dead 2, you know, Fighting Fighters Megamix, Knights, Burning Rangers, you know, ding. I'm just rattling off names here, and they've all got their own unique hook, their own unique feel. They've got something about them that makes you want to kind of go back and play them. And the graphics, for me, are not an obstacle. I just think there's, going back to that whole thing about identity, that the 3D look of the Saturn has such a great nostalgic appeal and just a look that I don't think, I think you had to have, I say you had to have been there, but then as Dan as we boys proven, you didn't have to be there because he's loving it.
Yeah. There's definitely a magic about them. Because my kids have played some of the older games on my systems as well. And you're right, mate, the memory's there. See, this is the thing, going through this now, I think I have these memories that make the Saturn my favourite games console of all time. You know, I know it's, if you're looking at it, you know, objectively, okay, it's very difficult to make it a case for it being the best, but it's my favourite by a country mile because
yeah.
I have such an affinity for it. The Sega PlayStation, if it was a thing, would have probably kept Sega around today. They'd still be around, may still be a force. Maybe have been absorbed into Sony. That would have been an amazing system. You know, maybe gone their own way and stayed alive. But selfishly, I want to hold on to those memories. I don't think I'd sacrifice something like Panzer Dragoon Saga for that, for Sega having that success.
Just imagine if we did have that DeLorean and that gaming almanac to go back. You've just got all these Saturn owners and Dreamcast fans. You know, what would the Dreamcast junkyard and Dreamcast years turn into? would the logo on Twitter, just like in Back to the Future, would it just fade out and change to something else? Would Sega Saturns across the world just vanish into thin air like Marty's hands on his photograph? Yeah. You know, I don't think I would never want to, as sad as the way things ended up, you know, I don't think it's certainly a route that I would have preferred. I think, again, the Saturn, like with yourself, I think it comes down to this as well, the way that the era we lived in and the way we acquired these systems, and also the story of my first Saturn's well known, but your history with getting the Saturn and Scott Cable, what's this? I need to wait to play it in the living room. And you know, that moment with me, we seen VF1 in the home for the first time. And I think a lot of that kind of allure and that nostalgic memory, they're special moments. Whereas now you just go onto a website and go pre-order.
Yeah.
You pay for it digitally, it gets sent to your door. It sets up online. There's no discs. Well, for me, there's no discs. You love discs. You've got a disc drive. But I don't know. I just think maybe it's that kind of whole clinical aspect of it. It's very streamlined now. Quite boring as adults to buy stuff. You know, we didn't. It was more fun when you could ask Santa for it.
It was, mate. It was.
I believed in Santa when I was 15, right? Just want to kind of clear that up. It was not that bad. But the ideas, I think these kind of childhood memories of getting these systems and what they meant to us, I think, is also a massive part of what drives that kind of passion that we've got for it today.
That's as exciting as it got, mate, but you're absolutely right. It was so much more exciting then. And I think a Sega PlayStation would have been exciting, but I wouldn't trade backing the horse that was successful and for the magic that there was the Sega Saturn, personally.
Yeah, but, definitely.
Well, I think that brings us nicely to the end, mate. And I'd love to hear what our listeners think, whether they'd, what would be stand out for a Sega PlayStation for them? How do they think it would have panned out? What would their favourite games have been? And just like myself and you, James, I would like to hear if our listeners would trade Sega's history post 1993 and see them still in the ascendancy today, but sacrifice the Sega Dreamcast, the Sega Saturn, and everything that came after that. So as always, you can catch us at The Sega Guys. You can catch myself at Swooper_D, and you can catch James at The Sega Holic. But thank you for listening, and until next time, cheerio.
Bye-bye.